You're listening to Love in the Time of Chasmosaurs, the podcast, the audio supplement to our blog of the same name about the science, art, and popular culture of mostly Mesozoic life. I'm Natty.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Gemma.
We are honoured by two guests in episode 33, by Elena Michel, co-author of The Art and Science of the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs, and by one of the busiest and most prolific of British paleoartists working today, Bob Nichols, whom we are especially pleased to have finally secured for the podcast. Elena and Bob will be speaking to Mark and Gemma about the recreated paleotherium at Crystal Palace, and many other things besides, later. Before that, our vintage dinosaur art title this month is Inside Dinosaurs and Other Prehistoric Creatures, written by Steve Parker and illustrated by Ted Dewan, published by Dorling Kindersley in 1993. But first, what have we been up to this month?
Well, plenty. Just hasn't really been dinosaur related in my case. I've passed my exam for the zoo, Oude Hans Dierenpark, so...
Many congratulations.
Thank you. So I can officially start working as a guide there. So if you ever find yourself in Oude Hans Dierenpark in Rhenen, you may just run into me.
Excellent.
Hey.
I can spend a couple of hours talking at you about animals. I'm just info dumping about my special interest. It's a dream come true. I have also gone back to Naturalis again, this time with Sarah Otterstetter, my good friend, who was over for my birthday.
Oh, yes, of course. That's wonderful.
Yes. So shout out to Sarah if she listens. I had a really good time having her over.
I'm sure you did.
Excellent.
Had a good day. Wish you could have been there.
Yeah. Also, I should say that Sarah was quite impressed by Trix, the large specimen of Tyrannosaurus rex that we have in Leiden, in Naturalis.
And really?
She has privately said that she might be up for a little reconstruction, showing especially the all the gnarly little pathologies that she has on her face.
Oh, brilliant.
And if she ever does get around to doing that, I'll feature it on the blog.
But we need to know, did Sarah compare Trix to Tristan in Berlin at all?
Yes, she did. And of course, Trix comes out on top every time.
And thus the eternal rivalry between Netherlands and Germany continues.
Haha. They kicked our bums at football last week, so.
Did they?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's news to me.
I have no idea. I know that Poland beat Wales in penalties. Good to know.
No, it was a classic German victory. It was 1-1, and then the Germans scored in the last few minutes.
Yeah, boring.
Mark, you went back to one of your old haunts, didn't you?
Yes, I went to the Isle of Wight last week. It's like a shot glass of England, the Isle of Wight. And yes, obviously it's known for its dinosaur remains, having the Vectis Formation and the Wessex Formation. Yeah, went back to Dinosaur Isle, of course, which fortunately has recently been granted lots and lots of money. Well, £500,000 from a government fund to repair the roof, which is threatening to cave in. So hopefully that will survive a few years longer. I mean, it is an internationally important dinosaur museum. They've got in there the Barnes-Hyde sauropod, the pink iguanodon, Eotyrannus, Ceratus sucops, and all kinds of things. So it's very, very important. It's a massively important collection. Also, we went to the Dinosaur Expedition Centre, which Peng and I have been to in the past, directed by Oliver. It wasn't open at the time, but I emailed Oliver and he let us come in and have a look around while it was closed. Just
a sort of preview.
It was very, very kind of him. I did pay a bit of entry fee in by recompense. But yeah, it was really lovely to have a look around while it was shut. No kids. So good to have a look around Dinosaur Museum with no kids. I can't tell you. Also had a great chat with Phoebe, who works there, about dinosaur toys. Also, of course, we went to Black Gang Chine while we were over there.
Of course.
On opening day, and got to enjoy all the terrible Chinese robot, like generic rubbery dinosaurs, plus the few remaining.
You have to
been some very dramatic landslides
there. You have to visit it before it falls
months.
Into the sea.
Yes, that's true of lots of places on the Isle of Wight. You have to visit the Isle of Wight before the entire island falls into the sea.
Before the island vanishes.
I mean, it's already happening. I mean, one of my favourite monuments in Shanklin is now cordoned off because it's so close to the cliff edge, is the little memorial plaque to Elvis in Rillstone Gardens, where the Isle of Wight Rock and Roll Society created a they put a little plaque to in memoriam to Elvis on the cliff edge, and now it's a bit too close to the cliff edge. It's been cordoned off.
Has Elvis ever been to the Isle of Wight?
No, but it didn't stop them. So, yeah, it's sadly now behind a fence, and you can't see it unless, like Agatha the Renegade, you're willing to nip behind the fence and look at it.
Criminals.
Anyway, lots of dinosaur-related fun was had on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, love to go sometime.
P.S. Bring back the Jurassic Club.
Oh, yeah. You do need to bring back the Jurassic Club.
And the scary singing Porsche Allosaurus.
Ah, the main course already. Wallace is improving. My stomach rumbles at the very thought of it.
I'm still perfectly willing to offer up my designs for a revamp of the Jurassic Club, you know, if you can get a word in some way.
Excellent idea.
So there you are.
Yes, do take it. The famous Natihi Himapan is going to design the revamped Jurassic Club. I don't know what it means, but go do it.
Oh, one other thing.
I will show you later.
There is a specimen in the Expedition Center, which is the genus is given as Reparo Venator, brackets, Nomen Dubium. So, you know, shots fired.
Really?
Shots fired.
Shots
there.
Fired.
Yeah.
Really?
Because it's from the same locality, from the same formation. It probably is the same genus, isn't it? It's probably the same.
Oh.
And now
well,
on to Peng.
You may recall my mentioning last episode that I've been busy working on something to be revealed in due course, and I can now tell you that these were 10 InfoStation illustrations for the new exhibition, which opened last week on the 18th of March at the Natural History Museum of the University of Zurich. The exhibition also features the beautiful sculptures of 10 Tons, the wonderful team of paleontological model makers, and contributions from some of our very own paleo friends, like Rebecca Groom of Paleo Plushies, Mieke Roth, Katrina van Grau, and Brian Eng, no less. Rebecca, for example, has made a Diplodocus plushie as an accessibility aid which visitors can take around the exhibition with them. Mieke has provided models of horsetails. Katrina has mounted a magpie skeleton which is being displayed alongside a giant model of one. And Brian Eng has painted an extraordinary mural of a Jurassic forest. And my contribution, as I said, were 10 illustrations for the info stations dotted throughout the exhibition. These were silhouette illustrations which were drawn originally in ink and to size for the infestation screens. And so far I've shared one illustration on social media, that of Diplodocus, and will probably, hopefully, be sharing a few others by and by. But the star exhibits, of course, are the four skeletal mounts from the Kirby Zebra collection. These are Barbara, the Nanosaurus, Big Al 2, the Allosaurus, Victoria, the Hesperosaurus, or Stegosaurus by any other name, according to some accounts, and HQ1, the Diplodocus. As I understand it, these four had been on a tour and were exhibited at the Big 8 Dinosaur Exhibition at the Hong Kong Science Museum before finding their home at Zurich. The new Natural History Museum itself is a reopening of sorts. It's a merging of the four natural science museums of the University of Zurich, which formerly consisted of anthropology, botany, paleontology, and zoology separately. Dennis Hansen of Zurich University and co-curator of the exhibition has started posting about all the adventures behind the mounting of the new exhibition over on Blue Sky under the hashtag NMZ Chronicles, which we will of course link to in the show notes so you can read all about it and follow the updates as they happen. And I do want to thank Dennis so much for commissioning me to be a part of this project. And for being, without exaggeration or mere politesse, the kindest, most patient and understanding person to work with. So there you go. If any of our listeners do make it out to Zurich, to the exhibition, we would love to hear from you. Tell us what you make of the exhibition and of what you see there. Gemma, you've met Kirby Zieber himself before, haven't you?
I have, yeah, a couple of years ago at the Oertijd Museum in Boxtel. because that museum has actually bought a few sauropods from his collection, one of which turns out to be a new genus, which I think they're still drawing up the manuscript for. We, if you recall, a couple of years ago, we had one of the scientists on that project briefly on the show.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yes, of course.
Yeah, so at the unveiling of the project where they were going to prepare those sauropods, I met Kobe or Kirby, Hans Jakob, Sieber. And yeah, he was perfectly nice. He gave me his book. So I have his book on his adventures on the Jurassic Mile, which is a good read. It's called, hang on, I've got on my shelf here. It's called The How Ranch Dinosaurs.
Ah, yes, of course.
And the author is Jacques Ayer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's about Sieber's adventures in the Morrison Formation, digging up all those famous specimens of Jurassic sauropods, and of course, the first and indeed second, Big Al.
Yes.
I would be really, really keen on going to the new museum in Zurich. I understand that for his original museum, Saurier Museum Atal, which is just outside of Zurich, they had all these impressive dinosaur mounts, but space was really, really limited. So
yes,
the way they mounted them was really flat against the wall.
Oh, I see. Oh, interesting.
I wonder if the new museum retains that, or if they're going to do proper 3D mounts. I haven't seen any photographs, so
oh, well,
I'd have to go and see it.
The ones at Zurich are very properly 3D. Yes, they are. They're not against the wall. So, that's especially exciting. But I'm sure Dennis will enlighten us further in his NMZ Chronicle. So do follow that if you're keen to learn more.
Yeah, excellent.
Let us turn to vintage dinosaur art.
Vintage dinosaur art.
Inside Dinosaurs and Other Prehistoric Creatures, written by Steve Parker and illustrated by Ted Dewan. This book was previously reviewed on the blog by both yourself, Mark, in 2011, and later by Victoria Arbour in 2016.
Yeah.
So
let's not talk about my review from 2011. It's probably quite embarrassing. I'm sure Victoria Arbour's review is a lot better.
Well, where would we like to start today, then, in that case?
Well, it's quite a spectacular book.
Yeah.
Especially for the time.
It really
Looking
is.
Looking back at it now. It's really remarkable.
Should we talk about the illustrator?
Ted Dewan. So
Ted Dewan, born in America, lives in London, I believe.
And
yes, currently.
In the year immediately before this, illustrated Inside Nature's... No, Inside the Whale and Other Animals, which was obviously about excellent animals. And then...
Which won him an award.
Won him an award. And yeah, a year later, somehow produced this book full of inside views of prehistoric animals, mostly dinosaurs, but also a few others. There are even some arthropods in here, remarkably.
Yeah.
Alongside, well, dinosaurs, pterosaurs, marine reptiles.
Yeah. As far as I can tell, this was his only ever foray into paleo art, because he went on to mostly do kid stuff, including Bing. Anybody heard of Bing? Bing, not the search engine, but Bing the bunny?
No, I have not, sadly. But
what?
But apparently that's quite critically acclaimed, or popular at least.
Bing.
Yeah. Well, you know, lovely. But
still around. Bing, still huge, apparently. Allegedly, citation needed.
Really?
But yeah, still around, doing his stuff, but no more paleo art from Ted Dewan.
All right. Well, this book owes a lot to John Sibbick and to whoever sculpted the models
that
appeared in various DK books in the early 90s. Because, yes, there is a lot of references in here to John Sibbick and those early 90s DK models. Okay, it's mostly Sibbick. So you have things like the Pachycephalosaurus, Euplocephalus, what, the Ankylosaurus, various others.
The Deinonychus as well.
Is that Sibbick, do you think? I really couldn't place that one. That's an odd one. That pose especially, it looks like it's kind of falling down a chasm.
Yeah, but it's
very odd.
It very much has that stance of the Dromaeosaurus with the hands turned up like, rah.
That's true.
I mean, if not directly inspired by Sibbick, it's at least quite typical of Deinonychus portrayals of the time.
Yeah.
The Parasaurolophus as well, very much based on that very famous...
Oh, yeah, that's
colourful Parasaurolophus head. I don't think that was in the Normanpedia, but it is a famous... Sibbick piece.
It's a combination, I think, of two Sibbick pieces. It's the Normanpedia Parasaurolophus, as you say, with the colour scheme borrowed from a later one. The later one had a sort of connecting tissue flap thing that went down, the more colourful one,
yes.
From its crest to, yes. to its neck, whereas it's generally based on the earlier one, which is more plain looking, sort of more grey-brown. But so, yeah, there's a lot of Civic, a lot of... But all the same, you've got to give Dewan credit for these remarkable cutaways. I mean, wow, the level of detail in these things is...
Yes,
that is an extraordinary amount of work for this book. With that in mind, it's probably no surprise that, as you observed, Mark, that Ted Dewan was given sole billing on the book's cover, as opposed to being joint with the author, which is highly unusual for books of the time, especially on dinosaurs.
You know, especially because, apart from the Inside Wales book, Ted Dewan didn't have that many books to his name, as far as I can tell.
No, I mean, from what I've been able to find, these seem to be his earliest books before his foray into other children's literature.
Makes it all more remarkable. I mean, can you imagine if the Norrenpedia just had Sibbick on the cover? Just John Sibbick, and no mention of David Norman anywhere. I mean, it's the equivalent of that. It's really quite amazing. I want to mention as well that there's a Diplodocus in here, which is obviously a cutaway, which sprawls over multiple spreads, and it's basically directly inspired by the Eyewitness book, the Eyewitness Dinosaurs from 1989, where the skeleton sprawled over multiple pages, except in this case, of course, you have it clothed in various layers of musculature and skin. And I love the way that on various reconstructions, the skin spirals around the skeleton with bits of muscle inserted in.
Yes.
I mean, it's so...
Yes.
Yeah. It's a real testament to the artist's skill, the way that he's able to, well, draw the skin spiraling around the skeleton and make it look so convincing. And yeah, this, as I said, remarkable attention to detail. I think there are some cases where it's fairly obvious that it's been... So the Brachiosaurus, for example, looks to have been inspired by a model that appeared in DK books around the same time.
Yes.
Which is now on display
in
the Dinosaur Isle Museum, in fact. You can go and view that model, this DK model. Especially there's the huge stomach, which is also featured in the DK model and in the testes.
Yes.
So that's digestion page we're talking about?
Yes, dinosaur
that's
digestion.
Right, yeah.
Which has a Brachiosaurus clearly inspired by that DK model, and then an Allosaurus clearly inspired by Sibbick, especially if you look at the sort of posture of the arms.
Oh, yeah. There's no mistaking
it's
that.
Unmistakable.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much like the Sibbick Normanpedia Allosaurus, which is just odd in many ways. The head is different, but yeah, the rest of it is clearly Sibbickian. Yeah, the Brachiosaurus, obviously inspired by that model, and yet. Look at the neck. Look at the way it's been reduced to a kind of a huge esophagus and trachea.
What does the neck cutaway pattern remind me of? You'd fold paper up and then bring some scissors to it and fold it out, and that would be your result.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah, it's a general sort of latticed, perforated look, isn't it? And yes, I see what you mean about the folded
peculiar.
Paper and scissors technique. But I'm almost afraid that it was almost going to trigger my trypophobia looking at it. Fortunately, it hasn't happened yet, so I hope that stays that way. Hmm. But as you say, that is an ingenious method of showing this. Very creative, yeah. And must have been extremely painstaking to recreate.
Because even the skeleton is gone in that image.
Yeah,
yes.
No skeleton.
Yes.
There's a partial skeleton down in the torso and towards the lower limbs, but there are no cervical vertebrae at all. It's just a trachea and esophagus, and that's it. And yeah, that weird latticed skin thing going on, which is... just endlessly visually fascinating to me. I can't help it. Because it's so... The artist needn't have done that. He could have just made a lattice skin or even just a cutaway.
Or just an open... Yeah, exactly.
I've seen plenty of artists do just that.
Yes.
But this spiralling, latticing pattern is
such
so...
Such a creative way of doing it.
Yes.
So visually arresting. And you see that again and again.
What I can't
book.
Look away from on the same page, that's page 31, there's... a dinosaur being compared to a sausage maker.
Oh, dear.
And the sausage goes into a fermenting vat.
There are a few instances of that in this book where dinosaurs are compared to machines. So in this case, you have the Brachiosaur that is as you said, compared to a sausage maker where the ingredients go in, squeeze into a tube, it's ground up and fermented. And then
veggie sausage, though, in this case.
Veggie sausage, yes, of course. And then at the end you have the turds coming out. There's a little cute green dinosaur guy with a clothesline clip on his neck.
I do have to say, I do love this touch of the little cute green dinosaurs that are dotted throughout the book, and they act, as you say, within the supplementary information and the comparisons, as little figures that demonstrate these machinery that you were just talking about. Yeah, I think they're a lovely touch.
Yeah, there's a lot to discover in the book.
They are a really nice touch. It just adds this... again, an extra appeal because they're so cute and friendly, and but at the same time they are variously being tortured in these images. I mean, you have one where on the tail enders page with Euplocephalus and the tail end of Diplodocus, you have one that's about to be thwacked by a big mallet on a spring,
which is
representing Euplocephalus' tail. Yeah, it's about to be obliterated and smushed.
Enemy surprise.
Which is fantastic. You just have these things. It just adds so much interest and appeal to the whole thing, and it makes it a lot more engaging. And then it's a good way of teaching people about the mechanics of animals again. So just
explains
directly to machines and having these little characters that are operating the machines, which is a great way of demonstrating how animals work and the process that go on inside. I just find it really appealing. And again, with the Deinonychus, you have a little guy operating a kind of... almost like a switchblade, where he's putting on little levers and the knife or the claw is going down. Loads of fun. Also, I mean, I don't really feel qualified to comment on the sort of muscular reconstructions. I think that we need someone like Matt Dempsey here to really comment on that.
Yeah.
But they seem pretty sound. I mean, you have the, for example, the musculature attaching to the chordae femoralis. So... where the relevant
musculature
is
actually...
That's
the big muscle at the base of the tail?
Of the tail, yes.
Yeah, the chorda femoralis longus. So
that's for the kids listening at home.
Yeah.
Chorda femoralis. That's a big muscle in your tail. feel your own tail and you can feel it.
Yes, if you're a lizard. It was a really... or a crocodile. But basically, in the 90s, it was really common for people to make dinosaurs too mammalian and really minimise that muscle or even eliminate it, whereas actually it was a huge and really important muscle in the animal that retracted the limbs, exactly the same as in a lizard or especially a crocodile. Obviously a crocodile being a more direct comparison as their archosaurs and yada yada yada, but yeah, at the time it was really common for that muscle to be minimized, and you see a lot of reconstructions where the dinosaur just doesn't have anything connecting the hind limb to the tail like that. But in this book, you do see that. So if you look at the Pachycephalosaurus, for example, you can see the, what's it called again? The trochanter, the attachment point on the femur for the chorda femoralis, and then there are muscles coming off of it and attaching to the tail. So
yes.
I really appreciate the level of detail. So this isn't just something where, I mean, we can tell just from the level of artistic skill on show, it's not some hack job, but really... they've been paying attention to the animal's anatomy and not just saying, oh, well, I did a whale and I did a whatever else is in that book, an elephant, I don't know, that now I can do a dinosaur. They actually did pay attention to the anatomy of dinosaurs as reptiles. So it's nice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
good. It's a really nice book. Yes. Also, it's a very entertaining retro Spinosaurus reconstruction on pages 34, 35.
Spinosaurus.
one of its many iterations.
Yes. This is the 1990s... it's basically a big theropod with a kind of allosaur head, and it's got four fingers for no good reason.
Yeah, this is exactly how it appeared in Dinosaurs magazine, wasn't it?
More or less, yeah. It was
just,
it wasn't quite lumped in with the, with baryonyx and so on at this point. It was just kind of a big theropod with short arms and small hands, but for some reason they had four fingers and, yeah, an allosaur-like head. But hey, it had the sail, so there you go. and it's all about showing the circulatory system. So it's all cut away,
yeah.
And there are no muscles at all. It's just the circulatory system, just the heart, a really big heart as well, remarkably large. So they're clearly thinking these things are active.
I think moving away from the cutaway stuff, I do really like the face on this one. It has these sort of sunken in eyes. It has this very grumpy face. It seems to have kind of loose hanging skin. It really looks like a very grumpy dinosaur, and it's full of character.
He looks moody. Yeah, you get a lot of character in these illustrations too, actually. Especially the, some of the herbivores you might imagine to be dopey, like the sauropods and stegosaurus, really, really look dopey. I think with the stegosaurus possibly too much. Stegosaurus looks virtually, you know, comatose. But
I don't know. I think the stegosaurus looks more baleful than dopey, if anything.
It's very retro, though, for this book. Given that the book is
it's very retro.
Yes, that is true.
It very much is built like almost a pre-Bourian. Very high back.
Yes.
Very much that bell curve shape that you also find in someone like Fliorov or Abel, all these pre-Bourian European dinosaur artists.
Yes.
And, of course, they have to bring up the walnut.
The walnuts.
That was de rigueur back then.
If I was a stegosaurus, I'd be billful. I'd be like,
yes,
every time with the walnuts.
You would make that exact expression, yes.
I am one of the most amazing animals that ever walked the earth. There is more to me than just a brain the size of a walnut. Give it a rest.
Give it a rest already.
Even among stegosaurs, it's very unique. I mean, that staggered arrangement of plates and the spikes and everything. Yeah. Most stegosaurs kind of look like a variation on Kentrosaurus, don't they? Whereas that...
Kentrosaurus is the norm, yeah. Stegosaurus is weird for a stegosaur.
Weird and big and interesting. So, yeah, really nice. Unfortunately, lumbered with that preconception from the 19th century. So, you know, who could blame this? 19th century paleontologists again. Those they're all there to blame.
The 19th century has a great deal to answer for in all aspects
it does,
of life,
doesn't it? It does,
unfortunately.
But we don't have the hindbrain in this one. That was a myth that was well put to sleep by this point.
Yeah,
that was gone. Obviously, that was just the usual neural expanse that happens over the hips, which we have as well.
That myth came from Marsh, right?
I'm not sure, actually. Where that came from exactly, but the hind brain, because
it was definitely a 19th century thing.
Probably it was around that time. Because that opening, which as I said occurs in basically every tetrapod, was larger than Stegosaurus, his actual brain cavity, people thought, oh, it's a second brain, and blah, blah, blah. But interesting to note that Stenonicosaurus also appears on the same spread as the brainy one, although its brain is also notably not that big either. Which,
no,
again,
hasn't it been compared to an emu the last I heard?
Yeah, but it's notable that Stenonicosaurus isn't shown as being some mega brain box. It's not, you know, on its way to being a dinosauroid or anything like that, which you might expect for the time. It just looks like a kind of slightly silly birdy theropod. Not as birdy as it would be nowadays, but it has that kind of big blank eye, a kind of big blank stare going on, which is great, because that's exactly how it should be.
That's how birds look.
Exactly.
That is how they look.
So it looks like, in that one aspect, not in many others, because obviously it's a very early 90s reconstruction, it's completely scaly with small hands, but in that one aspect, it looks like a bird, which is perfect.
Yeah.
So they haven't made it into some kind of uber brainy thing that can, you know, solve Rubik's Cubes in a
Not
second.
Quite smoking a pipe and hatching an escape plan just yet.
No, exactly.
T-Rex. I see a T-Rex on page 13.
Go on then.
No, you mean page 11.
I do mean page 11.
You do mean page 11, don't you? But the T-Rex is based on a DK model from back in the day, from back in the
80s. Very much so.
Yeah, I can recognize it. Yeah.
You can see it.
And the smaller drawing next to it is that exact thing replicated.
Yep, it's basically traced over. Yeah, it's, you know, it has a weird neck because the model had a weird neck, a weirdly short neck. I think maybe it's designed to be manipulated into different positions and animated, hence its slight oddness. So it's sort of twisty. But yeah, the neck's oddly wimpy looking for a T-Rex, and the legs are way too straight, which again, that's from the model. The muscles, I guess, are fine. It's mostly about the teeth. So it's showing you how there are replacement teeth coming down from in the jaws. Again, T-Rex is always let down in these books. I think other animals get a better deal than T-Rex. T-Rex being the most famous and obviously best dinosaur of all. And yet,
I'm not sure if I disagree with you there, Mark. I think this T-Rex is on a par with the rest of the dinosaurs in this book.
Yeah?
Yeah. It has the same sort of playfulness to it. It's very derivative, but all the other dinosaurs are as well. But because he does bring his own style to it, and because he is so playful and in his way so creative with with doing this. I think he can get away with making the animals kind of derivative in other ways.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah.
That is true. I agree with it too. Isn't it boring when we all agree on things? But yeah, you're right. He does get away with it. In fact, you've articulated something that I actually thought as a kid, the fact that he gets away with it with these illustrations being derivative because they are, because he puts his own spin on them and they're charming.
That's exactly it, yes. Yeah, you know where his sources and references are, but they are exactly with his own hand, his own imprint, which for a book of that time, which so heavily referencing the things that came before it, is another breath of fresh air, I think.
Yeah.
I just want to say that in terms of the technique, I'm especially fond of it because they're very close to my own choice of materials and my way of working. This very finely hatched, but in his case, in Duan's case, much more spontaneous line work. But the finely hatched ink lines and watercolour washes are an especially favoured combination of mine, so I'm obviously very much drawn to that. So, yeah, in light of everything we have been discussing with the way his own handprint is on this illustration, the beautiful, highly skillful technique, the sense of humour, and the creative methods in showing the cutaways, I think this is just a beautiful, really beautifully realised book, and so much work has obviously gone into it. And I remember Victoria Arbour saying in her review, in her blog post, that she would love to see a book like this again, with our revised understanding of dinosaurs today, but done, if not by the very same author and illustrator, then by somebody else, but working in the same way. And I really would agree with that. I would love to see this freshly realised today.
Yeah, I agree. There's nothing like this out there at the moment.
No.
It would be fantastic to see.
Well, who knows? Maybe Ted Dewan is in the market for this. Put that Bing money to good use.
He could be persuaded to come back to it, perhaps.
I spent a lot of money from that search engine.
We are very honoured to have two guests on the show today. First of all, we have Science Associate at the NHM, official best friend of the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs, and co-author of The Art and Science of the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs, Eleanor Michel. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, hello. How nice to join you.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm really doing very well, looking out the window at Crystal Palace Park and looking forward to telling you a little bit about the current state of affairs here.
Okay, I can't wait. Also joining us is, and I quote, Britain's leading paleo artist, and noted guy who made that thing, Mr. Bob Nichols. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I can't see any dinosaurs from my window, but I do have a nice park.
That's lovely. So both of you have last year, and I suppose a little bit before that, been involved in something quite extraordinary. I should say Eleanor has been granted a new neighbor, as last year in the summer, a new, old, revived sculpture was unveiled on the geological court at the Crystal Palace Park. Who would like to start?
I think Eleanor has a better memory of this than I do. And I think I came in a little after the plans were being put in place. So I'll let Eleanor lead at this point.
Okay, well, I'll start with how it looked from my side. I received an email from Mark Whitten and Bob Nichols. Bob had written to Mark saying that he had this idea of recreating one of the lost sculptures in Crystal Palace. He said in the email, he phrased it so marvelously, he said one of his great heroes of paleo art was Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins, and it would be a great honor to work on the site. And Bob can tell us a little bit more about how this came to be for him. This email landed in my inbox and said, I would really love to recreate one of the sculptures that was on the site for a long time, but has subsequently gone missing, of which there are actually a number.
Yeah, there's 8, I believe.
About 7. And we can never quite count these things properly because it's hard to define what's an individual. And we're also in the process of the research for the book that Mark Whitten and I wrote. It came to light that there were a number of sculptures that actually hadn't even entered into the archival records. Those came out through doing archival work. Yeah, so, but one of the sculptures that's basically within living memory was the Paleotherium Magnum. And it was Bob's idea to recreate that from the images that are known. And he and Mark got together and gave it a good hard think from a paleo-artistic perspective. Then it took about 2 years, basically, to go from that stage of proposing the idea to finding some funds, finding the right moment to make it happen, and a very intensive amount of work on Bob's part to actually deliver the sculpture. And then we installed it last July 2nd, I believe it was, in a beautiful sunny day in Crystal Palace Park with a lot of celebration and events surrounding it. I was an enabler and bystander and cheerleader on the whole thing, with support of some of the Friends of Crystal Palace Dinosaurs trustees. We wrote a grant to fill in some of the funding and contributed funding also from donations from the public, which is what we get on a regular basis. And we delivered this sculpture. I should say Bob and Mark really did, but it came back to life on the site.
That's absolutely beautiful. So, Bob, what really gave you the idea? Was it like looking at these old photos? Because there's really only one good photo left of the original Paleotherium Magnum, is there?
Yeah, there are only a few resources to use to bring it back. Yeah. The idea came from way back, really, because like most people who are interested in the life appearance of prehistoric animals, I've grown up with books with lots of photos of the Crystal Palace dinosaurs in them.
Yes, we definitely have.
Yeah. So I've grown up with them. They've been a part of growing up for me. So I knew of them, but I'd never visited the park. I think I was in my mid-20s when I first visited the park and got to see them. And it just so happened to be at a time when there was a reconstruction process. So there were people on the island actually repairing the sculptures with concrete and cement or whatever they were using. And I was lucky enough to get to go onto the island and see what they were doing. And I was watching them working on it. And I was thinking, have they got any idea of how important these sculptures are? What an important part they play in my profession, in paleo art. You know, they're like the mecca of paleo art. So I thought, God, I'd love to just use my fingers to just make a few marks on it so I can say I've worked on the Crystal Palace dinosaurs. But I didn't have the nerve. I thought, I don't want to be that guy who just gets in there and gets in the way when they're trying to do their job. So I never did.
Plenty of those people around.
But I always regretted that. I thought, God, that was not a real unique opportunity to play a part in their reconstruction, and I missed it. So for like another 20 years or so, I thought, oh, what a missed chance. And then I knew that Mark and Eleanor had been talking about the park and they were doing the book. And I can't actually remember the early conversation about choosing Paleotherium quite as clearly as Eleanor does. So I'm glad she was able to explain that. But yeah, I really thought, well, maybe this is an opportunity for me to, you know, contribute to the return of the park to its original state and bring back one of the lost sculptures. So it was really a 20-year longing that made me really want to do it. Because I'm not really a sculptor so much anymore. I've always done sculpting as a kind of to help bring in enough money from paleo art as a job. So, but I don't really need to do them now. I can be a full-time illustrator. So there aren't many jobs that would bring me back to building models, but this is definitely one of them. I'd drop everything to do another Crystal Palace dinosaur.
So you have no great love for sculpting, for model making then, because obviously some of your models have attracted huge acclaim and interest. So it might be somewhat surprising to hear that you'd much rather just purely focus on illustration.
We might as well name it. We might as well say Psittacosaurus, right? Everybody knows your Psittacosaurus.
But there are other things too. Like there's the Lipurudon. I think it's Lipurudon head at Bollesden Hall now. So it's not just the Psittacosaurus.
Yeah, I've done maybe hundreds, primarily small models for museums over the years. So, yeah, and it's not that I don't enjoy it. I just think I'm I think I'm a better illustrator than I am a sculptor, because I look at some of the 3D reconstructions by other sculptors around the world, and I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could do it. But there, I don't think, you know, I think I can compete with anybody in the world with illustration. So I'm just following. Also, I'm hoping to do this until I die, right? And it's easier to sit at a computer painting than it is building a life-size model. They're hard work. They're physically demanding projects. That's when fair. You build a sculpture. So if I want to do this until I die, it's the illustration route that I've got to go along.
Bob did a fantastic, complete series of photographs during the construction phase of the new sculpture, the new Paleotherium Magnum. And it's fantastic. We stitched it together into a sort of a slide film. And I was overwhelmed at the intensity of the work, the physicality of it. I mean, it's a big sculpture, took a lot of materials and movement and forward planning, but there's also a lot of intense chemicals being used in the fiberglass process. It was extraordinary. I hadn't quite realized how much physical work it was going to be. And I had the great pleasure of dropping in on the studio while Bob was working on the sculpture. And wow, it was cool. But I can see why it wouldn't necessarily be the way you want to spend every day from here on out, because it took a lot of work and was really very intense to deliver it on time.
Yeah, a lot of the materials are, well, first of all, they can be very, very expensive, and most of them are pretty unpleasant to work with, or you have to take a lot of precautions to make sure you don't get poisoned by them or have skin irritants left on you. So yeah, they can be pretty unpleasant materials to work with. And also, like, temperature can affect them enormously. It just so happened to be the hottest June in history, I think, when I built the model.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
So I was in my workshop building it, sweltering heat, baking. But, of course, I had to remain completely covered so I didn't get, a fiberglass strand on my skin and things like that. So it was a challenging month. But, the final product I was really pleased with. I spent a lot of time getting it as close to the photographic evidence, what evidence we had. But it paid off, I think.
Yes, I did see that slide video that you mentioned. So we're just going to link that on the show notes page as well. So, Bob, tell me, you've made this decision. You're going to make this sculpture. All that survives really is a couple of old dodgy photographs. How hard was it to get it exactly right?
Oh, well, to get exactly right is impossible. What we've done, we worked together to make some decisions on how to interpret some of the missing pieces, because we had, like we've been saying, we've got only a few photographs and a few illustrations to work from. And they're all predominantly from one side. They're all from one side as well. There is one picture, I think of when the original sculpture was being installed, where it's led on its side, and the particular photo means we're looking as if we're looking down on it. So that was able to give me an idea of what angle the head was turned and the shape of the torso and things like that. So, it was basically, I spent a lot of time staring at photographs, and so did Mark too. Mark Whitten spent a lot of time looking at these pictures and helping me interpret them. So we just had to extract every bit of information we could from very few images. The one that I just mentioned, where the sculpture was led on its side, was particularly useful also for the feet, because in all the other photos, pictures, you can't see the feet, that it's obscured by foliage. Right. So that one picture allowed me to see the shape of the toes and things like that. And there was one illustration that showed the length of the tail. It has an elephant-like tail, but that broken off in the other photos. So yeah, we had to extract every bit we could from wherever we could to get the finished piece. And it was tricky. And it was kind of my first ever historical reconstruction, right? So my day-to-day life is trying to recreate the life appearance of extinct animals according to modern understanding. This wasn't that. What I was trying to do is reconstruct Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins's his vision. And that was quite a new job for me, a new experience. And I'm just thinking another challenge was that reconstruction work had been done to this sculpture throughout time. So we also had to identify the bits that had been reconstructed and weren't original. And some of that reconstruction work hadn't been done very well. So I had to kind of ignore it and try to fill those gaps with a way that was plausible, as if Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins had done it. So I had to kind of copy his style from the rest of the sculpture and apply it to those missing areas, those reconstructed areas.
It's something like when paintings are restored and people have to, occasionally you have, you know, people restoring paintings intermittently over a period of decades or even centuries, and some people do it rather better than others. And you hear these stories of people having to chip away at layers of really dodgy kind of, you know, like layers of paint slathered over where they really shouldn't be.
Yeah, it was a bit like that, yeah. So I didn't realise that would be the case when we first started, but yeah, as we were looking at the photos, it became clear that some of the damage had been repaired in a not particularly helpful way. It kind of was probably obscuring some of the information that we needed to make a perfect reconstruction. So we did the best we could. There was a long debate over the size, so we had to kind of work out how large it was from looking at the photos and comparing it to other objects in the photos. And we had some brief film footage we could review and calculate the size of it from the people in the footage. So yeah, it was an exercise in extracting as much information from minimal resources, and it was fun.
I think one of the things that we learned from it also is the importance of bringing specialists in paleo art into the conversation, because earlier work was on conservation of the sculptures has been done pretty much exclusively by conservators, arts conservators. Right, yeah. I mean, they're highly, highly skilled in many aspects of material sciences, and they have a strong artistic component to their backgrounds and interests. However, they don't have the specialisms or specialities in reconstructing animals necessarily, and especially extinct animals and sculptures of that kind. So working with Mark and Bob was really an eye-opener, and I think it should be a lesson, should we say an object lesson, in how the conservation work should go forward in the future. And that is, it really should be bringing together the people who've been thinking about these sculptures, in Bob's case, 20 years, the Crystal Palace dinosaurs were incubating in his heart. And for many of us, it is many decades of thinking about these exact sculptures. And I think there needs to be a real collaboration and exchange between people who are doing that. That said, the site is Grade 1 listed, which is the UK's highest historic sort of designation. Yes. And what that means, that listing they've been listed at Grade 2 for quite some time. And then 2007, they were upgraded to Grade 1. And then 2020, the sculptures and the site, the geological court, was upgraded to heritage at risk. And what that means is that any work on the sculptures now has to be done by accredited conservators, which is a good thing. It's receiving the recognition it deserves, but it also presents a little bit of a conundrum for us, because paleo artists are not necessarily certified as conservators, because it's a different line of work. So we're trying to, the politics of this is bringing together the people who we see as specialists in our corner, the science and paleo art and history corner, and bringing those people together with certified conservators who are now the ones given access to the site more readily through contracts and the work by Historic England.
It certainly helps to have an obsessive paleo artist involved, I think, because Mark was helpful with the eyes, of reconstructing the eye with paleo theorem, because some of the photos aren't great resolution. So when I was trying to sculpt details like the pupil in the eye, I wasn't sure what to do. And then Mark pointed out that we could actually, it looked similar to how the eyes had been sculpted in some of the other dinosaurs. So it took his kind of obsession with the subject to realize we could use those sort of we could use that route as well to pick out details. So it pays to have obsessives involved, I think.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if there had been any friction at all, or if everyone had basically got along well and cooperated, because as you said, it's now necessary with the upgrading of the sculptures of the whole park to have approved conservators. I mean, has there been a recognition of the benefits of bringing in, as Bob said, obsessives into this? Or has there been a little bit of tension occasionally? I mean, how's everyone got along there?
Maybe I'll answer that from the sort of the politics platform of getting things done in Crystal Palace Park. I mean, I think Bob and Mark are really a beautiful collaboration. And as I said, I felt honored to be sitting on the sidelines and watching the discussion. And I should also give a shout out to fellow trustees on the board of our charity, the Friends of Crystal Palace Dinosaurs. That's Adrian Lister, who's a very lauded paleo mammalogist. We had input from Jennifer Kreese, who's similarly a paleo mammalogist, and Jerry Hooker, etc. I mean, we sort of tapped the scientific community, and I think everybody pulled behind this project in various ways. That said, sort of getting the project off the ground and getting funding is, of course, a bit of a challenge. We had good support from the new Crystal Palace Park Trust, and they funded about half of the costs. But getting things done, it just takes an enormous amount of work. There have to be things like risk assessments and applications for permissions to do things. And that is fairly draining kind of work. So I wouldn't want to point at any particular individuals, because I think everyone did their best within the jobs that they were doing. But I would say that was the hard part, really, from my perspective, is getting these things to actually happen. I mean, I saw this beautiful project sort of growing, blossoming on the artistic side. And I, you know, my job was to make it happen, deliver it on the ground. And it was a little bit nerve-wracking sometimes, because I wasn't always sure that we were going to be able to make it, you know, to actually put it in place. And boy, was I glad when that sculpture came out of Bob's truck and was carried down the pathway and put into place. That was just a great moment.
I suppose you mentioned it's getting the recognition it deserves now as you said, the mecca of science outreach and paleontology. The start of it all, somewhere where things were finally interpreted and presented to people in a way that's accessible. But for a long time, it was quite neglected, wasn't it? I mean, is that fair to say? For some decades in the 20th century, the site was not really looked after, maintained properly. It's only now that it's been really recognized.
I mean, it was around that time that the original Paleotherium Magnum disappeared without a trace in the first place, right? Nobody knows when it went missing and how and who took it.
Exactly, yeah. The last photograph we have is 1963, I believe. It was standing behind what they call a dragon's tooth fence, a really nasty looking fence where a bunch of the sculptures were corralled. Yeah, that's when Paleotherium Magnum disappeared. There's a history of change in who is responsible for the park. Mark Witten and I outlined that in the book. And you can actually see quite clearly the presence or lack of attention to the sculptures and recognition of and the park in general. Through that time. And I think there were major changes. I think the really major changes came in sort of the 80s and 90s when surface maintenance of the sculptures was not maintained and was not continued. And that basically allows plant growth to start. It starts with algal growth and then moss and then crack propagation and water ingress, freeze-thaw processes.
Oh, yeah.
And sculptures start falling apart. The inside infrastructure, which is metal, various kinds of iron, started to the rate of rusting increased. And that iron, as it rusts, it expands. And so that started to sort of accelerate the cracking process even more so. I would say in the last decades of the 20th century, that started to accelerate, and it was recognized in 2001 to 2003. There was a very major conservation effort, and it looked like a bright and shiny future for the sculptures and the geological court. However, the maintenance was not continued. And so we basically formed as an organization. By 2013, it was evident that the sculptures were in really declining and acceleratingly bad condition. So we formed the charity Friends of Crystal Palace Dinosaurs and started pressuring the council, who are the landowners, to actually step up the conservation or maintenance process. And we're still in that today, so a decade, over a decade now later, and we have some success. So on the horizon, there's a big grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund. A fair amount of it is going to be put towards conservation of the sculptures. We're hoping that that will bring it back to a good, stable state again. And then the other point is to actually make sure that it doesn't just turn into a major conservation intervention and then a stop. We need to make sure that there's maintenance that carries on. Yeah. That's been the weak point overall. And for that, we need to bring together the public, their interest, their ability to help us put friendly pressure on the site managers and owners, the public's interest in being engaged in all the various ways that might happen, and then also keep it on the radar of those managers and owners of the site. So that's what the job is right now, and we're very, very busy with that. I'm in meetings all the time trying to keep that on the radar of the powers that be.
Just a little extra on that. People have become so accustomed to seeing them rather neglected that I had quite a few people ask me if I was going to, or if I could. Adjust the paintwork on the new Paleotherium to make it look weathered like the other ones. Yeah. But really, the others, you know, when they were originally created, they would have been, you know, cleanly painted and rather shiny compared to what we've become accustomed to seeing. So rather than making the Paleotherium look weathered and a bit neglected, the idea, I think, is to now make the others look rather polished and fresh.
I can sort of see the point there, blending it in and making it look like it's the original in the sense that it's neglected as all the others. I mean, maybe you could paint some faint moss, sort of fake moss on it, or put some cracks in. But no, I agree that it's better because you're never going to make that really convincing. I don't really get the point of it. It's better to not pretend that it's old. This is a replacement.
But also having the new Paleotherium Magnum there is going to almost be an incentive to do that because it does look different. It does look more polished. And because it's made from a different material, it's going to age different, isn't it? It would be an incentive to polish the rest up and have it to the standard of that one.
You know, just get Bob to replace them all with new sculpts. maybe Bob could do a Megalosaurus next.
I was trying to convince Eleanor to let's commission let's bring the mammoth that was never built, but that was a no-go, I think.
Well,
rather wishful thinking.
Yeah, it's not completely impossible, but I think we're in a situation of triage where we need to repair the sculptures that are actually falling to the ground.
Yeah.
There were, I think, about 15, maybe 17 sculptures that were planned by Waterhouse Hawkins that were never built. And the mammoth was built, I think, there's indications that it was probably built up to its knees,
right,
and then dropped as a project because Hawkins received a very harsh letter one September afternoon that said, sorry, dude, your funding is cut. There's enough extinct animals out there to do the job. And so his vision was not fully realized, but his vision included many more extinct mammals that wasn't realized. And we've had discussions over the years, and it's really fun to think about that. But then a lot of this brings one back into the philosophy of conservation and of a historic site in particular. And I think after living with the decisions for a while, I think it is quite important to try to keep an eye on the fact that it's special because it's a historic site. It's not because it represents some extinct mammals. And I mean, we do frequently get the question of why don't we update everything? And actually what we want to do is backdate everything to the 1850 vision.
It's the last thing you want to do.
Yeah, that's where the story is how science changes our vision through time. So basically we're trying to recreate Waterhouse Hawkins' view and exactly what he did. And it also gives me a moment to mention that we have been also, in addition to the artistic work, we've been 3D scanning everything that we can so that we've got a really fully detailed record of where things stand now. And one of our project partners, Reese Griffin, has been doing that on his own. Yeah.
We love Reese.
We love Reese. We love Reese. We interviewed him on our most recent TetsuCon episode. So if you want to listen to that one, he's on that and telling you all about that.
Oh, fab. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there are lots of things to prioritize before I sculpt some mammoth knees.
Yes.
Well, just the fair
knees.
Enough.
Just up to the knees, nothing else.
Just up to the knees.
Yeah, it's historically accurate. I would take the opportunity to the dumb, obvious stuff for Bob, like formative paleo art influences, for example, who you were most inspired by when you were back in the day, maybe when you were kids starting out illustration.
All the usual 1980s and 1990s sort of well-known artists like Greg Paul, Mark Hallett, John Gertsch. I'm never quite sure of how to pronounce his surname. I used to really like Brian Franczak as well, but he disappeared. I think there's a bit of controversy there. I'm not sure what it was. But the primary influence for me was Doug Henderson. I think he's the best that's ever done our profession. I think his work is beautiful. And I always loved the way the animals that are often focus of most paleo artworks was kind of, they almost looked like they were stumbling through the scene and accidentally got captured in this, what was intended to be a landscape. I thought that was a unique take on the subject, and I don't think anybody has done it anywhere near as good ever since. So I would say he's my number one, yeah.
I always call Doug Henderson your favourite paleo artist's favourite paleo artist.
You're right, yeah.
I mean, we were talking recently about the global view, Dinosaurs, a Global View, you know, that 1993 Cherkis book with Hallett and Sibbick and a few others in there, and also Henderson. And Henderson's work does stand out because in most of them, the animals are the focus, but in his, as you said, it's just landscapes where an animal happens to be wandering past.
Yeah, his work just gives me emotions that no other paleo artist does. It's just like you really do feel like the image is a window into the past. And I find that just, wonderful. Nobody has done it as good ever.
I suppose another thing to ask might be favorite jobs of yours so far that you can talk about. Anything that you took the most pride working on? Possibly difficult question without, you know, because there is a risk you will offend people. But
although I've just been saying that I consider myself primarily an illustrator, I've got to say this Itacosaurus, because what we did with that fossil and with that model was really memorable. It was remarkable. It was also one of the first times I ever had my name as a co-author in a paper, which I never thought would happen. I didn't excel at school. I'm dyslexic. I have terrible memory. So I never expected to have my name on a science paper. So to have reconstructed the life appearance of a dinosaur from a fossil so accurately, with even color information and scale information, and then that model was experimented with, and we were able to determine what environment Itacosaurus lived in, that was amazing for me. I'll never, that's a career highlight. And that certainly makes me smile every now and then. To have been a part of that project was really special. And I even got to go to the Senckenberg and spend 3 days staring at that incredible fossil. Yeah. It was just a magical project from the beginning. And then after that, we did the cloaca paper, and that they talked about it on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and stuff like that. He talked about it for 4 minutes. I mean, it was, the whole Itacosaurus project has been amazing, really. That one stands out. But anything I do for like a big museum, murals and things like that, they're always magical things. To keep being able to make a living from my lifelong obsession is always exciting. I feel like I win an award every time I get a commission. It's great.
And there you go. You're just out there doing the work. You're an example to all of us, Bob.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I work obsessively. I work all day, every day, and evenings. And yeah, I worked at 2 o'clock this morning, just working on things that I like working on. So I guess kind of an obsessive attitude towards creating artwork is kind of helpful, I think.
Yes. Although, you know what this means, of course, because now you said that your favorite, well, one of your favorite projects ever to work on with the Stegosaurus, it means you've got to do more models, Bob. More models, more and more models. Yes.
More models.
Get that same high. You've got to do more.
Try not
of it.
To breathe in any glass fiber.
You realize this, right?
Yeah, I've got to avoid the resin. The resin fumes are particularly dangerous.
All right. Well, Bob, Eleanor, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been fantastic talking to you both.
Thank you for your interest. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been really a pleasure. Thanks.
And we wish you all the best. I'm optimistic about the future of the Geological Court. Thanks for that. And we hope to see you again.
Thank you.
See you in Crystal Palace.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
I still have to bring my partner there.
Yeah.
All right, all right, all right. Thank you once again to Eleanor and Bob. I've been wanting this interview for so long.
Yes, we have.
It's a shame that Bob had to contact us over AM radio, but nevertheless, it was good to hear from him.
Yeah, we had to telegraph him using Morse code.
Yes, his dodgy webcam mic.
Yeah.
It's okay, Bob. We're grateful. We're grateful. Please come back.
But yeah, congratulations once again to the, especially to the Friends of the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs Foundation. What a wonderful project to have been able to restore one of those missing animals and bring it back to its original spot. It's a wonderful thing. Next time I'm in London, I have to go check it out. Mm-hmm. Have you, Ben? Because you don't live too far away, do you?
I don't, but I'm afraid I haven't still. It reopened back in February, I believe. So I should look forward to doing that very soon, too.
I've seen them twice now. The first time was with my mother, actually. So my mother's seen them, too.
Excellent. I mean, I personally think the Crystal Palace dinosaurs should be awarded World Heritage status. But, you know, I'm maybe just a little biased.
Well, they're already listed as high as they can be within the British system, right?
Yeah.
So I guess World Heritage is the next step.
Next step.
Maybe we can someday campaign for that. Also, we should have campaigned, of course, for the 70s Dinosaurs of Blacang Chine.
Yeah, too late now. They should have been listed. Now we've only got like Stego Slug and a couple of others left.
Yeah.
Ugh.
What is the world coming to?
At least part of that T-Rex could have been saved.
This is not a good end. This is not.
This is no. This is no way. This is no way to end the podcast. Hey. We will look forward to the next episode, whatever that may bring.
It was lovely speaking to Bob.
Yes, we've no plans yet, so we're open to suggestions.
We'll be just as surprised as you are.
Yeah, next month we'll be listening to the podcast and we'll be hearing our own voices and we'll be just as surprised as the rest of you.
Thank you all for tuning in once again.
Yes, thank you so much once again.
Yes, thank you for listening. Thank you, Nati and Mark, for podding with me once again.
Thank you, Gemma.
Even though Marcus is a bit less than sober this time, but I think you've kept it together quite well.
Only a bit less.
Only a bit.
What have we here? Tasty morsels, to be sure. Come closer, will you? Let me take a closer look.
I don't think anyone is ever going to listen to this podcast again.
For those of you who are unfamiliar, that is testament to just how much Mark loves Blacang Chine and the Triassic Club specifically, because that was a word-perfect impression of the Allosaurus in the Triassic Club as was. So there you go.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, thank you for listening. If you're still here after all that.
Thank you so much, everyone. Goodbye.
And do tune in next month. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Love in a Time of Chasmosaurs, the podcast. Your hosts were Nati Himapan, Mark Vincent, and me, Gemma Hazeborg. You can find all the images and links we discussed today on our blog at chasmosaurs.com. You can find us on social media at Love in the Time of Chasmosaurs. If you want to give us your support, please leave us a comment or a good review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support us on patreon.com/LITC. Our music is by Rowan Long, who can be found at bronzewing.bandcamp.com. Stay safe, stay curious, and we hope to see you again soon.
The main course already. Wallace is improving. My stomach rumbles at the very thought of you.
Well, we had better not keep him waiting. He hasn't the patience he was born with. And that was ages ago.
Allow me to introduce myself. I am Darwin the Allosaurus, who some have the cheek to call the other lizard. Now, what have we here? Tasty morsels, to be sure. Come a little nearer, will you? Let me take a closer look.